The Best of Our Knowledge explores topics on learning, education, and research. Coming up, we'll learn how an endangered antelope was born to a mother of a separate species. A new report from New York examines declining public school enrollment. And lawmakers are celebrating the return of whole milk to the cafeteria. I'm Lucas Willard, host of The Best of Our Knowledge. You're listening to The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. The Eastern Bongo is a critically endangered antelope that's native to Kenya. With only 100 animals left in the wild, the rare animal faces an uncertain future. But a recently born Eastern Bongo named Pope could signify brighter days ahead. In November, Pope was born from a surrogate mother of another more common antelope species at a Texas facility operated by company Infinity Exotics. To learn more about Pope and the successful interspecies embryo transfer, I spoke with wildlife veterinarian Dr. Will Weiss.
Back in the mid-80s, there was some research on, we call it today interspecies embryo transfer. Basically, can one species be a surrogate to another species? It was proven almost 40 years ago that there's several species that can carry others. One of the species is one that, you know, I've been working on. So it's not necessarily a new concept. It's been around for 40 years, which is pretty amazing that 40 years ago they were able to do some of this stuff, because it's hard even by modern standards to do. But, you know, our goal was to basically take this knowledge and see basically if we could make this really efficient so that we can use it to help conserve species, especially endangered species. Critically endangered species like the bongo.
Yeah, in this case, we're speaking about a bongo antelope whose name is Pope.
Name is Pope. Yeah.
And what can you tell me about this species, Pope's species? What does it look like? Where is it found in the wild? Take it away.
Yeah, Pope is an eastern mountain bongo, which is only found in one specific part of Kenya. There's estimated to be around 100 to 140 of these animals left in the wild. If you've never seen them before, they're really beautiful animals. They're kind of a orangish auburn color with white stripes. They're a large antelope species.
And so the antelope that carried Pope's when Pope was an embryo was a separate species. But was it a similar species when we're speaking about the world of antelopes in continental Africa?
Yeah, so the surrogate we use to carry Pope is another species of antelope. It's called the common eland, which is one of the world's largest antelope species, and they're humongous. they're very impressive up close. It was discovered in the 80s that they were close enough that the bongo could carry an embryo from an eland antelope. So that's the project that we've been working on for the past few years.
And so when you are trying to transfer an embryo of one species and transfer it to a surrogate mother of another species, obviously there's a genetic difference that I imagine can create some difficulties in having that embryo be able to actually stick, if you will. Why is that, though? I mean, are you looking for a species that is similar enough? Is there a common issue that does occur when you are trying to move an embryo of one species into a surrogate mother of another species?
I wish I had a very detailed, complex and scientific explanation for that. The Bongo and Elin actually have different chromosome numbers, but their placentas are close enough that the Bongo embryo is able to implant correctly into the uterine wall of the Elin, and it doesn't seem to have much to do with necessarily the chromosome number, but there is a fetal maternal recognition that takes place there, and the Elin just recognizes the Bongo as its own pregnancy.
And how long is the gestation period? What was the waiting game like when you're waiting to see? Yeah. And were there progress checks that were made when you're seeing Pope develop in the womb of another animal?
Yeah, so this is one of the most common questions I get asked. So the gestation of an eland is about 275 days, and the gestation of a Bongo is about 285 days. So it's about 10 days longer in the Bongo. And it seems like when we do these interspecies embryo transfers, that the developing fetus, the baby, sort of determines the gestation length. So the baby basically tells the mom when to go into labor and when to give birth. So Pope actually went 292 days of gestation, which is long even for a Bongo. we did lots of routine checks, lots of sonograms. We really babied this mom, and Pope, when he was born, is probably the biggest Bongo antelope I've ever seen at birth. Big baby, and the mom is a wonderful mother. She takes care of it. She nurses it. She takes care of it just like it's her own. She completely recognizes it as her own. And it's really a special thing to watch an eland nurse and take care of a Bongo, you know, a totally different species as if it's its own. It's pretty mind-blowing.
Now, is Pope larger because of those extra few days in the womb, or is it because maybe there's more space in the womb of an eland antelope versus a Bongo mother antelope?
Yeah, I wish I knew for sure. This is kind of a one-shot deal, so we don't really know for sure. I think it's probably a combination of those things. Pope is sure a big, big, healthy baby. And to give you an idea, when he was born, he's about the same size of a one-month-old. So he was quite a bit bigger than we were expecting.
What about this process and in bringing Pope into the world differed maybe from the technology that was available 40 years ago or anything that or just maybe more scientific understanding? What differed with this instance than maybe what was even possible decades ago?
Yeah, so we have about 40 years worth of research to kind of fall back on now, which is nice. So embryo transfer is actually really, really common in the beef cattle industry and the dairy industry. Most of our dairy especially is from animals produced through in vitro fertilization and embryo transfer now, just because we can use these technologies and make our animals so much more efficient. We can breed for certain traits and make our animals more efficient. So the idea here was, one Bongo can only give birth to one offspring per year. The idea there is, we have a really rare species of the Bongo, which is critically endangered, and we have a very common antelope species, the eland antelope. One Bongo can only give birth to one baby per year. So one female gives birth to one baby per year. But we can use this technology that we've been working on developing to collect a lot of embryos from one female every year, upwards to say 20 or 30, and then implant those embryos into the eland antelope And so instead of having just one baby per year, we can have one bongo female giving birth to, say, 20 or 30. So that's the idea of this technology. And admittedly, it's not as efficient as that yet, but I'm hoping in the next few years we can work on making it really efficient so that we can increase numbers of these endangered species really quickly.
And not just antelope, I'm sure,
Sure.
right? Is the idea to expand this to other species as well?
Yeah, there's plenty of other species this works with. I actually have like an Excel list of all the target species that I'm, that some have been proven, some have not. But there's quite a few species. Like you said, not just antelope, but other ones as well. Yeah.
So, Dr. Weiss, where will your research take you next? I mean, we just talked about some of the possibilities, but I want to know what's in your future and what's in Pope's future as well. Where will the study continue?
Well, tomorrow actually we're doing more embryo work on Bongo. So every time we do it, we seem to gain a little bit more knowledge. So we're just going to continue working on that. And Pope is living his best life. He's still nursing. He's 2 months old now, and so he'll be weaned at about 6 months, 6 to 8 months, and hopefully he'll go into a breeding program here in the next few years. But yeah, for me, my goal is to continue to develop these technologies. We have some other things kind of in the works, and we've been working on different species like there's endangered zebras, for example, that we've been working on. So like I said, there's lots of other species, and I think over the next few years we'll have quite a few, hopefully some more breakthroughs like this. Yeah.
Well, wonderful. And thank you for sharing. And I look forward to hearing more in the future. Thanks, Dr. Weiss.
Sure. Yeah, thank you very much.
Dr. Will Weiss is a wildlife veterinarian involved with company Infinity Exotics. You're listening to The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. Nearly 90% of school districts in New York State are experiencing a decline in student enrollment. That's according to a new Cornell University study, which examined enrollment data from 2013-14 to the 2023-2024 school year. At the same time, while only 1.8% of New York students are homeschooled, that rate is twice the percentage from a decade prior. A similar dynamic is playing out at charter schools, where enrollment more than doubled to 6.5%. To learn more, I spoke with Leslie Reynolds, a Cornell Research Support Specialist. I asked if the public school enrollment data follows similar trends in statewide population decline.
There's often a question of, is the enrollment decline happening because of COVID-based trends? But really, it was a longer standing trend and driven by, like you said, the declining population and the decreasing fertility. So having fewer babies and also waiting later to have babies, and therefore fewer. So there's fewer children being born, and there's also an aging population. And so what you have for the population change, we like to call the balancing equation, births, deaths, and migration. And you can apply that to age groups as well. So if you have your 0 to 4 year olds, the kids that you would have going into school, if you're having fewer births in an area, you'd have to make up for that in migration or people with children moving in. And if you don't have that, there you would see a declining K-12 population as well. So we do see that as part of a longer term trend and very much entwined with the large scale demographics of the state as well.
What stands out to me in this report is the increases that we see in both charter school enrollment and homeschooling rates. Through your analysis, have you determined any likely cause as to why parents might be moving away from public school?
It's hard to pinpoint a cause, especially in research, where we like to have a research question for every single topic, or you want to find out so you plan methodology just for that, but we think of as a general cause. I know I said that COVID wasn't the cause of the trends in terms of numbers, but it doesn't mean it didn't have a social or cultural impact. So I think part of it, at least recently, is the growing choice. And we had some social changes during that time that have changed the way we work and the way we learn and increase the possibilities. You know, we can homeschool more, we can do virtual learning, or you can do hybrid learning even at public schools. And I think there's also been a growth in charter schools in general, and there may be offering choices or programs that the public schools don't have in their area. So I think growing choice is the biggest part, but it's hard to pinpoint exactly, you know, when or for what reason, especially when there's so much variation among districts too. So even these big trends that we see, some districts experience them in different ways and could be entirely opposite. There could be growth in an area or entirely reliant on charter schools. So it's really dependent on the area, but I think growing.
Well, I'm also reminded that this is a time where a lot of politicians are trying to champion the issue of school choice. It's become a political platform among many, you know, among those who are seeking office and those who hold office as well. So is there any sign that that kind of political language is driving parents to make any decisions about where their children receive their education?
It's definitely hard to tell from a researcher's standpoint, but I think that's all part of the cultural and social inputs that we get. And I think people have their own priorities when looking at schools, and that's influenced by your social needs and political opinions. And so it's impossible to completely separate those things. And I think trends are often driven by that political and social factors as well. It's hard to say exactly, but I think that the agency of where to go has been increasing for a while. And so I think it's an important topic.
Now, charter and homeschooling rates, are they increasing in other areas in the country as well? We're talking in this report about the New York State numbers, but did you or your team look at how New York compares with other states when it comes to enrollment in non-public school?
No, I haven't. I'm quite sure. Well, I've looked at other research about charter schools, and I think it's a national increase in charter school enrollment, but I didn't look at the differences across states. This was just focusing on New York State and then the districts within it when we could.
Now, I also want to talk about statewide graduation rates, which is also part of this report as well. What can you tell me about the trends in graduation rates in New York?
Sure. Well, we've seen a gradual increase over the last 12 years or so. So it rose 7 percentage points over the past decade. So going from 79% in 2013-2014 to 86.3% in 2023-2024. And it was interesting to me when doing this report, and I'm not sure if this is a well-known observation for people who do more work in education, but that girls in New York State had a higher graduation rate than boys, and that followed the increasing graduation rate as well. So there are two parallel lines, basically, with the boys' graduation rate starting at around 77% and going up to about 82%, with the female going from 83% to about 90%. So there, it was kind of an overall growth, but to see that difference for girls and boys was interesting to me.
Sure. And the report also includes rankings on how school districts themselves actually spend their money, how they utilize their school budgets. What can you tell me about some of the areas where schools may actually spend the most money? What have been the highest expenses for school districts? And does that also follow trends that we've seen over the last several years?
Yeah, that's a nuanced question as well. And so we looked at the top five for specific expenditures, and we picked kind of the largest or what you would expect the largest being instructional and transportation. And there's also some nuance in the way these are calculated as well. And so Hempstead stands out as the top instructional expenditure. So 70% of their total expenditures are spent on instruction. But so we looked into this for other factors during the analysis as well. And they actually have a larger virtual and hybrid learning than other school districts. And I can't remember the exact number, but it was they ranked highest in that as well. So if you have over half of your instruction being virtual, then that's what you would spend the most money on because you have to pay your teachers, but you might not have as many physical or building costs or transportation, because if you can have fewer places to transport, you can have fewer buses, or if it's mostly for home. So all of those kind of go together, but also the transportation, East Ramapo and Cheektowaga both spend about 15% of their total expenditures on transportation. And so that could speak to the distance or how far they have to go, or maybe just how many buses they need. And so we liked pointing these out just to kind of draw attention to different issues and maybe spur on some additional research questions or places of interest for future research.
And that's what I wanted to ask you next is, where is your research immediately going to take you next? Are there any leads in particular in this story that you're interested in?
That's a good question. I was talking to someone earlier who asked about the impact of immigration on the enrollment, and especially since this data was from the five-year ACS from 2023. So it's a little bit behind the influx of international migration we as a state had in the past few years, especially in New York City and areas. So this might have a little bit of lag in terms of children coming into the state. So it would be really interesting, I think, to look at as recent as possible the new enrollment trends and kind of keep an eye on it. But, you know, for data availability, you have to wait, and especially international migration is difficult data to deal with. And actually, a future brief, I know we would like to focus on international migration, but data availability is difficult. Earlier this year, we did domestic migration, so we kind of have an idea to do a partner brief focusing on international migration, and then international migration of children and young children would be very interesting to me.
Well, Leslie, thank you so much for taking the time and speaking with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. It was a great chat.
Leslie Reynolds is a research support specialist at Cornell University. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. Last Monday, Congress passed a bill that would allow whole milk to once again be offered in public schools across the country. As WAMC's Southern Adirondack Bureau Chief Aaron Shello Levine reports, the legislation has been a rare spot for bipartisan agreement.
In 2010, Congress passed a law limiting the kind of milk that can be served in public schools through the U.S. Department of Agriculture's National School Lunch Program. In 2012, those changes went into effect, taking whole milk and flavored milks out of cafeterias across the country, leaving skim and 1% as the only fat content options available.
That's been a big hit to our dairy farmers. It was a punch in the gut. And they've been trying to have it changed ever since. There were studies at the time suggesting that limiting whole milk in kids' diets was healthier. But there are new studies that show actually it's better to have whole milk. It's healthier, number one, and number two, it reduces obesity rates, and the kids like drinking it a lot better. So they drink more of it. We all know milk is so healthy for you. So the studies now show that we should have whole milk.
U.S. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer spoke Monday at A. Ohms & Sons Dairy Farm in Volusia. Last month, the Senate unanimously passed the Whole Milk for Healthy Kids Act of 2025, which revises the USDA's meal program guidelines to allow whole, reduced fat, and fat-free milk to be served in schools. Monday afternoon, the U.S. House of Representatives followed suit, and the legislation has proven to be a rare point of bipartisan agreement, with co-sponsors ranging from New York Democratic Senator Kirsten Gillibrand to Iowa Republican Senator Chuck Grassley. Regionally, it's the kind of bill that has the support of Republican Congresswoman Elise Stefanik, who is running for New York governor, as well as the support of Schumer, who said research on milk fat content has changed in the past decade.
The old studies are outdated, the new studies are correct, and we need to do it. The bill is a win-win for New York dairy farmers who can sell their products for kids, and the kids, it's a win for the kids, it's a win for the dairy farmers, and it's a win for the kids who will have more healthy and delicious drink to have. It's about time we brought whole milk back to our school lunch and food programs, plain and simple.
Ashley Sardo, manager of national affairs for the New York Farm Bureau, said the lactose legislation will be a boon for New York's roughly 3,000 dairy producers that make more than 16 billion pounds of milk annually, making New York the nation's fifth largest dairy state.
While it provides schools the option to purchase whole milk, it has real impacts for dairy farmers. Not only will this increase demand for whole milk, but it creates a market opportunity for our dairy farmers. This will pull milk that has currently been separated out of butter, cheese, or milk powder into the fluid stream or class one market. So what does this mean for farmers? As we know, dairy farmers are price takers, not price makers. It means that the shift in fluid milk could lift our prices that dairy farmers receive for the milk they produce. In turn, this will create greater opportunities for milk producers.
Eric Ohms says for every 100 pounds of milk sold, his farm pays 15 cents to promote dairy products across the country. Think the Got Milk commercials. For Ohms, this legislation begins to reverse more than a decade of misunderstanding that has left farms like his unable to offer a full range of milk to local schools.
For generations, we've been saying milk is healthy, and that messaging is finally getting through. Okay, so that feels good because we put a lot of money into promotion, but we can't promote Hudson Valley Fresh, we can't generic, promote Cabot yeah. Cheese, we promote generic. Well, we promote the benefits of milk. And it feels good that, because, you know, it seemed like people didn't care.
Reporting for the Southern Adirondack Bureau on the campus of Skidmore College, I'm Aaron Shello-Levine for WAMC News.
If you'd like to tell the best of our knowledge what you think, send us an email at knowledge@wamc.org. You can listen to the best of our knowledge anytime as a podcast, downloadable wherever you get your podcasts. If you want to catch up on past episodes or hear more WAMC National Productions programs on the news, academic study, books, women's issues, the media, and the environment, visit wamcpodcasts.org. This has been The Best of Our Knowledge, episode 1836. The Best of Our Knowledge is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. Thanks to associate producer Madeline Reynolds, the latest on all national productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter and on our flagship station's website, wamc.org. Until next time, I'm Lucas Willard.